This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On August 13th, Cuba's President Fidel Castro will celebrate his 80th birthday. After 47 years in power, he's beginning to show signs of age. 5 years ago, Castro fainted during a speech in Cuba. In 2004, he fell from a platform, shattered his knee, and broke his arm. Some suspect that Castro had a series of small strokes recently. Others believe he suffers from Parkinson's disease. Succession, long a taboo subject in Cuba, is discussed more and more openly. And a recent article about Fidel's designated successor, his younger brother Raul, led many to believe that a campaign to prepare the country for the inevitable is underway. But Raul Castro is himself 75 years old and unlikely to command the same kind of loyalty. Who's in the second tier of leadership? Could there be a struggle for power? What will the United States do? Later in the program, a drug test comes up positive on the American who won the Tour de France on Sunday, and the story of an attack by German spies on a then-neutral United States during World War I. But first, Cuba after Castro. Will socialism survive? Will a transmission be smooth or not? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. And here with us to talk about Cuba and what might happen after the Castro presidency comes to a close is Tom Gelton, on leave as NPR's national security correspondent. He's at work on a book that's titled, at least tentatively, Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba. And Tom, nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Neil, it's great to be back in the air.
Yesterday, Fidel addressed an audience of 100,000 Cubans in Bayamo in southeastern Cuba. This, of course, an important anniversary event in that country, the ceremony that marks Cuba's National Rebellion Day. How did he look? How did it go?
He looked pretty good, considering that I think it was last week or the week before we had yet another rumor that he had died. So every time he makes an appearance, all those rumors get put to rest. He's 80 years old, and if he doesn't have Parkinson's, he's got something that causes him to shake from time to time. He loses his memory. All of those signs were in evidence yesterday, but he's looking all right.
Mm-hmm. He was in Argentina earlier this month.
He made an appearance at the Mercosur, the summit group, the South American summit group. There he was in tandem with Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela. And he is enjoying, I think it's fair to say, right now, a kind of a resurgence of some popularity in South America because of his close relations with Hugo Chavez in Venezuela and also Evo Morales in Bolivia. So leftism, if not Castroism, has made a bit of a comeback in South America, and Fidel likes to see this as some kind of vindication of what he's been preaching for the last 50-odd years.
So as far as anybody knows, he could, of course, get hit by a bus tomorrow. He could live for another 20 years. We don't know. But what's in place for his succession?
Well, Neil, you know, I think that the Cuban government is in a terrible position with respect to planning for the succession for one simple reason, which is that for all the time that Fidel Castro has been in power, he has really resisted sharing authority with everyone. He has insisted on making all key decisions himself. And as a result of that, and in connection with that, you've had a very centralized system of governments, with the result that you don't get local leadership, you don't get people accustomed to taking responsibility themselves, making their own decisions. The result of which is that there really isn't much authority in Cuba outside the person of Fidel Castro. He can make announcements or pronouncements right now about who's designated to succeed him, but almost everyone who's in a position of power in Cuba, whether it's Raul or whether it's any of these other second-tier people, owe their position in power to Fidel. Once he is gone, and someone who is absent the scene, who is dead, no longer has authority, it could be a complete chaos. It could be a vacuum of authority is, I think, an understatement of what Cuba could be facing. And everything that Fidel said about what he wants to follow after him, in a sense, goes out the window because he's not there to make sure it does.
Mm-hmm. Who would control, let's put this in basic terms, who would control the army? Who would control the police?
Well, Raul Castro would definitely control the army. He's also has the Ministry of Interior Forces under his command as well. And this is the one factor back to think that we can rely on, at least in the short run. Raul has been defense minister. He's been commander-in-chief of the Cuban armed forces from the very beginning, right from the triumph of the revolution. He does have great loyalty among the Cuban armed forces. So we can certainly assume that in the short run, he would have control over the security forces in Cuba. And that is very important because he would be able to maintain some kind of order. Again, the question, though, is the one that you raised at the beginning. How long can Raul, if he's in this position, maintain that authority? But in the short run, I think we can assume that the security forces would be loyal to him.
What about that second tier of leaders? Who are they? What positions do they hold? Do they have, as you're suggesting, they do not have any independent source of claim on leadership?
Well, some of them have track records now in the Cuban government. I mean, you have someone like Carlos Laje, who's secretary of the Council of Ministers, kind of the ranking technocrat, as it were, in the top Cuban leadership. He's 54 years old. He's been in charge of the Cuban economy. He is certainly a competent person and has, as I say, he has a track record of achievement. I mean, he's not a fool by any means. You have Felipe Perez Roque, who's the foreign minister, a very young man, 41 years old. So he was born after the revolution, came to power as Fidel's personal secretary at the age of 21. He is someone who completely owes his position in Cuba right now to his closeness to Fidel Castro. And I think there would be, he's someone who is mentioned as being a logical person to play a leadership role in the days after Fidel is gone. But how can someone who doesn't really have any authority outside of what Fidel has bestowed on him have much of an independent base to operate? I think that's a really important question. You have Ricardo Alarcón, who is 69 years old, familiar to Americans because he speaks English and is kind of the designated spokesman for the Cuban government in dealing with the foreign press and in receiving U.S. and foreign delegations in Havana. So he has met over the years many, many times with Americans, speaks very good English, represented Cuba at the United Nations, was at one time Cuba's foreign minister. So a very familiar face both to the U.S. public and to the U.S. government, but also very closely allied with Fidel and has really served as Fidel's spokesman in the international arena. So I think with all of these people, you can raise legitimate questions about what kind of authority could they draw from once Fidel is gone.
And one other question, Tom, before we widen the conversation, and that is there has been a campaign in Cuba these last couple of years, the War of Ideas, as it's termed. This is some, can you characterize this as a campaign to try to preserve the ideals of the revolution?
It depends on how you define ideals. I would say it's an attempt to preserve the ideology of the revolution rather than the ideals, and I think there is a difference. The ideals, you know, I would say have a lot to do with the achievements of the Cuban Revolution in the fields of social welfare, education, and healthcare, and so forth. But the ideology of the Cuban Revolution, as defined by Fidel Castro, is really a Marxist-Leninist ideology, and it very much is opposed to any kind of semblance of private initiative, private enterprise. And one of the key aspects of this war of ideas has really been a war against individualism, a war against any form of private enterprise. Cuba was forced in the early 90s for economic reasons to really open up the economy and to allow some limited forms of self-employment, some limited private enterprise, was forced to bring in foreign investment. Now, thanks largely to the financial support that Cuba is getting from Venezuela, that need is not there so much. And Fidel has made it clear that he doesn't like tourism, he doesn't like foreign investment, and he definitely does not like private enterprise. The War of Ideas, in one important way, is an attempt to sort of push back against all these liberalizing notions that have crept into Cuba in the last 10 years or so.
Let's bring in another voice in this conversation. Brian Littell is a senior research associate at the Institute for Cuban and Cuban-American Studies at the University of Miami. He's also the author of After Fidel, The Inside Story of Castro's Regime and Cuba's Next Leader, which comes out in paperback this coming November. From 1990 until 1994, he was the National Intelligence Officer for Latin America, and he joins us from the studios of our member station in Miami, WLRN, and it's nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And as you look ahead to this inevitable event, do you think it's going to be a smooth transition? Do you think that it could be difficult?
Well, I think the most likely scenario is that it will be a fairly smooth succession. There has been so much time to prepare for it. And Raul Castro has been the designated successor, as you've heard, since the earliest weeks of the revolution, since, in fact, January 1959. He controls the two most powerful forces on the island, the military and the security services, as you heard. He's run the military since 1959. He's run the security services, including intelligence, since 1989. He also now is more and more in charge of the day-to-day operations of the Communist Party. Just recently, in the last month or so, he reconstituted the secretariat of the party. And it's dominated, the membership is dominated by people who are very close to him. They're called Raulistas. Hmm. In addition to those three institutions, the three most powerful institutions in Cuba, Raul, through some of his generals, also controls, directs a very large segment of the Cuban economy through military-run enterprises. So he's the man to beat, and I think that almost everybody else in the Cuban leadership is going to see the logic of staying with Raul, of supporting him in a smooth, hopefully a peaceful change, transfer of power. But how long he can retain power is another question.
And would this transition be toward a more liberal regime, a return to those early years of the 1990s, or a more authoritarian regime?
Raul is noted for a very interesting duality of character. On the one hand, he has a well-earned reputation for ruthlessness, for holding fast to very draconian policies over the years. He was the regime's most prominent executioner. He was its most notable Stalinist for many years. But I believe that the other side, a much more compassionate, humane side of Raul, is now more dominant in his personality. I think there's a good chance that if he's in power in his own right, Raul is going to want better relations with the United States. He's going to want to loosen many of these constrictions, many of these intransigent policies of Fidel. Time will tell. He might not have the choice, but I think that's the best bet.
Thanks. We're going to have to take a short break. If you'd like to join the conversation, by the way, give us a call at 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In his speech yesterday, Fidel Castro had a message for the United States. Don't be scared, he said. He won't be running Cuba when he's 100. The Cuban president turns 80 next month. Our focus today is on what happens in Cuba after Castro. Our guests are Tom Jeltner, reporter who's covered Cuba and national security for National Public Radio News, and Brian Littell, senior research associate at the Institute for Cuban and Cuban American Studies at the University of Miami. And, of course, we welcome your questions. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And let's begin with Kenneth. Kenneth's calling us from Waterboro in South Carolina.
Mr. Cohen, how you doing? I love your show.
Thank you.
My question is, could this be a door opening for the United States? And my second question is there anyone in Fidel Castro group beneath him willing to break away?
Break away from?
From the idea that from Fidel Castro.
Okay. Brian Littell, why don't you take that last part?
Yes, I think that overwhelmingly the Cuban leadership and the Cuban people are anxious, even desperate, for change, for liberalizing economic change, for greater personal freedoms, for the opportunities that are denied them to travel internationally, to engage in small-scale private enterprise. So yes, I think the Cuban people, and I think very largely in the Cuban leadership, there's a very strong desire for change. It's the reason why I was saying earlier that I think Raul Castro will favor such change. I think for Raul, the model that he will most likely follow or want to follow is the China model. Small-scale economic liberalization, gradual, cautious at first, while retaining very hard political control.
And Tom Jelton, let's turn to you for that first part of the question. Is this an opening for the United States?
if you look at the Helms-Burton law, which right now governs U.S. Policy toward Cuba, we are, as a country, prohibited from having relations with Cuba if Raul Castro is in power. The legislation specifically mentions the name of Raul Castro as being one that would define a new government there as a successor government versus a transition government. However, I think how much of U.S. policy in the future can be explained by what's on the books now, I think, is an open question. I think if you look at, for example, Iraq, we have found that we had to really improvise as we went along. And in the end, I would not be at all surprised if a future U.S. administration decides it's in U.S. interest to change relations with Cuba once Fidel is gone, even if Raul is in power. I would not rule that out, even though the Helms-Burton law right now effectively makes that illegal.
Mm. Kenneth, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Marifeli Perez-Stable is Vice President for Democratic Governance at the Inter-American Dialogue here in Washington, D.C. She's the author of The Cuban Revolution, Origins, Course, and Legacy, a regular contributor to the opinion section at the Miami Herald, and she joins us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Nice to be here.
Cubans talk about succession. The U.S. government talks about transition. These are two different things.
They are two different things, and what is interesting is that in Havana, transition is taboo, and in Washington, succession is taboo, and both sides officially say that the other side or the other alternative is unacceptable. I believe, in fact, that a succession and a transition are not incompatible. You can have both, a succession that eventually leads to a transition. But unfortunately, that is not something that current U.S. policy, particularly through the two reports that the Bush administration has issued, is contemplating. And that is unfortunate because, as Tom was saying a minute ago, the fact is that when Castro, Fidel, is gone, and if his brother is alive, Raul Castro becomes the head of Cuba, Cuba will be very different because you can't hold power for more than 50 years, disappear, and then expect things to go on as if he were still there. And the caller, Kenneth, is right. It would be an opportunity for the United States to take advantage of. And I just hope that when that time comes, there are, you know, the good old-fashioned trait of American pragmatism comes to the fore.
And might reflect itself how?
Well, for example, if the new government, a succession for a while, begins to open up the economy, which is, of course, not the same as opening up the political system up, but that would be a significant change, and it would be a significant change in the lives of ordinary Cubans who would see their hardship eased somewhat. That manifests a different type of disposition on the part of the leadership, and you have to explore through dialogue whether, in fact, that disposition can deepen.
And might that kind of economic reform be critical to generate popular support for whoever it is that follows Fidel?
Popular support, yes, or at least what the government has lost, popular support, in my opinion, but perhaps most critically is the willingness of the people of Cuba, of the ordinary Cubans, to listen to what the government has to say. And so opening up the economy, allowing small private enterprises, would really perk up the ears of ordinary Cubans.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is George. George calling us from Kansas City.
Yes, I had a question regarding the Cuba Libre movement and wanted to see what your guests thought of whoever is in charge of Cuba after Fidel goes, if this would energize them or perhaps take some of the wind out of their sails. What they think of that.
Brian Littell, you're there in Miami.
I'm going to pass. I'm not sure what the Cuba Libre movement is.
I presume it's the anti-Castro movement you're talking about, George?
Yes, just, you know, all the expatriates who, you know, grit their teeth and I just am wondering how that community, if they have indeed one voice, how they might look at someone like Raul Castro or someone else in his retinue.
I understand the question now. There's very strong opposition to a Raulista succession, to another Marxist-Leninist government, a dynastic succession in Cuban exile quarters. But I've been living here in Miami now for 6 months, and it's been very very clear to me that there's not a monolithic voice any longer in Cuban exile circles. Cuban Americans represent just about every point of view, every political point of view, political parties, and there's quite a variety, quite a diversity of Cuban American organizations that advocate very distinct and very different positions, with respect to American policy. I think implicit in your question is will there be extremist elements that might try to seize the initiative? I think that they would be very, very small, very remote, very much out of the mainstream. So I do think that the diaspora here of Cuban Americans is going to play inevitably a very major role in the reconstruction of Cuba after a transition to free markets and to democracy begins to take place. And I think that's inevitable. Mm. And it's inevitable, too, that wealthy, prosperous, professional and skilled Cuban Americans are going to take part in that.
Mm. Mari Feli Peristabuli?
Yes, I agree with what Brian just said, and I'd like to add the following. Fidel Castro, for better or for worse, is much, much larger than life. Raul Castro is not. Meaning that when he's gone and we speculate about the post-Castro Cuba or the post-Castro Miami, but the fact is we're not there yet. And we don't know how we're going to feel when, in fact, we know he's 9 feet under. I'm saying that by way of also saying that once he is gone, perhaps the first person to be relieved will be his brother, and that it will not be, Raul Castro will not rally whatever support the government has within the Cuban people in the same way as Fidel Castro, but neither will he garner the hatred of the opposition in Cuba or the opposition in Miami. So there might be rays of possibilities to open up new avenues with Raul, in spite of the fact that many people in Miami say absolutely no to Raul.
Mm-hmm. Tom Jelton?
Well, I would just want to underscore Mari Feli's last point, which is that whether you're talking about the resentment and the anger of Cuban-American exiles, or if you're talking about U.S. policy toward Cuba, in both cases, it has been so highly personalized for so long, it has been so focused on the person of Fidel Castro, that without that focus, I think it's very hard to predict how people would feel and how the U.S. government would respond. I mean, the regime in Cuba is a Fidelista regime. It is not in that sense, it's something much different than just a communist regime, which has gone through different stages of leadership.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call, George. Let's turn now to Howard. Howard's with us from Ithaca, New York.
Hi, Neil.
Yes.
Yeah, hi. By the way, enjoyed seeing you in the Will Short movie recently.
Well, thanks very much. Starring role, yeah.
That most of the discussion of the succession seems to assume that Raul will be the successor. Now, Raul is 75 years old. What's known about the state of his health? And what does anybody have any thoughts on what would happen if he might actually predecease Fidel or mm-hmm. not survive very long after Fidel's death?
Brian Littell, how's Raul doing?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. And Raul is 75. He's known to be an alcoholic, unreformed. And he's been drinking. My research indicates that he's been drinking heavily since he was a teenager. That's a long time.
Mm.
Raul's health is as much of a mystery, if not more, than Fidel's. I think we're pretty sure Fidel suffers from Parkinson's, but we don't really have good evidence or information about Raul's likely infirmities. The point, I think, of the question is really good. If Raul dies first, or if he dies soon after Fidel, what's going to happen? And I like to say, remind people that there is no third man. There's never been a third man, a third person in the leadership. When you used to look at the Soviet Politburo standing up on the mausoleum in Moscow when, in front of parades, you could see the pecking order. There was a third, a fourth, and a fifth in the line of succession. The Castro brothers have never permitted that in Cuba. One of the secrets of their longevity and power, each of them in his own right, is that there's never been a third man in line behind either one of them. Most likely, if Raul dies first, or if they die in quick succession, the most powerful men, the most powerful individuals on the island are the generals, the 2- and 3-star generals. But what would happen is anybody's guess. There might very well be a breakdown in the system.
Mm. Howard, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And third man, I wish I had some Cuban zither music ready to play. We're talking about Cuba after Castro. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Mari Feli, Howard's question opens up, could there be, in such a context, a struggle for power? Could things get out of control? People are talking about fearful of another wave of emigration, which might, some say, then justify a U.S. Military intervention.
Right. Well, I think a struggle for power is inevitable. And the danger for Cuba is there aren't any clear rules on how that struggle for power would be conducted. In the old line of the old-time communist parties, there were all sorts of struggles, but there were unwritten but well-known rules within the bureaucratic political machinery on how one achieved greater power. Those rules are not very clear in Cuba. So a Cuba without Fidel and without Raul would mean that at least all my bets would be off.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another caller in. This is Kai. Kai calling from Atlanta, Georgia.
Yeah, I have a question, Mr. Littell, about Raul and his image. Will the Cuban media be able to rehabilitate that? The people I've spoken to on the island, even the ones that don't like what's going on, still kind of like Fidel, and they really dislike Raul, or doesn't it matter at all?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's been true. You're quite right. I think that's the main reason why the Cuban media, very recently, beginning in early June, have been conducting a fairly intense campaign, an ingratiating campaign, to show the other side, the softer side of Raul, if you will, the compassionate, humane Raul, Raul the family man, the father and the grandfather. There was a long article, I think a very, very momentous article, in the Cuban Communist Party Daily newspaper on June 2nd or 3rd, coinciding with Raul's birthday, 75th birthday. And this article went on and on at great length to explore the softer, more humane side of Raul. It was I thought it was sort of the opening shot in the public relations campaign for creating a new and better image of Raul, to make him more acceptable to the Cuban people, who, you're right, historically the Cuban people have not really cared much for Raul.
Hmm. Tom Chilton?
The one point that has to be kept in mind is that the Cuban news media are totally under the control of the Cuban government and ultimately under the control of Fidel Castro. And there's no doubt that if this, you know, when this laudatory coverage was organized, it was no doubt Fidel's decision to do that. And I think the question with respect to how he is perceived, how Raul might be perceived in public, will go back to the issue of a power struggle. I mean, there are clearly Raulistas, but there are also people in Cuba who, in the current leadership structure, who may have their own ideas about replacing Fidel. And the question then becomes who will control. There will be a battle for control, not only of the government, but also of the news media and various forms of public communication. So I think that it, even if Raul is alive, you could still see some pretty serious competition that might very well be reflected in the public media.
Now, Mari Feli, we just have a few seconds left. The issue, who could establish legitimacy other than the Castro brothers?
Well, let me just say that a Raúl leadership of Cuba will not be a Raúl, but Raúl by himself. He will establish a collective leadership, and unlike his brother, and not saying he is he's not a Democrat, but nonetheless, he has experience in a collective leadership in the Army. So I think that that's very important to keep in mind.
Okay, thanks very much. Kai, thank you very much for the phone call. And Marifeli Perez-Tablé, thank you for your time. She's Vice President for Democratic Governance at the Inter-American Dialogue here in Washington, D.C. She joined us in Studio 3A, along with Tom Jelton on leave from NPR to write a book tentatively titled Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba. Tom, get it done. Get back here. And also our thanks to Brian Littell, Senior Research Associate at the Institute for Cuban and Cuban-American Studies at the University of Miami. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
After a short break, we'll talk about Tour de France winner Floyd Landis and his trouble with a doping scandal that emerged today. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.